This is the Country Hour with Megan Hughes on ABC Radio Queensland.
Good afternoon. Thanks for your company. Did you get much rain over the weekend? It absolutely poured where I am in Rockhampton yesterday afternoon. Looking at the Weather Bureau, the totals, Rockhampton had 52 millimetres in the last 24 hours to 9 o'clock this morning, and there were some pretty big totals across central Queensland. Calliope had 112 millimetres, Marlborough 57. To the Wide Bay and Burnett, Bundaberg had 50, Hervey Bay 74, and Eidsvold 27. And then up in the northwest, Flinders Cloncurry Junction got 52 millimetres and Floraville 54 millimetres. How much rain did you get at your place? You can send me a text on 0487 993 222. You'll also hear from the Bureau of Meteorology after 12:30 to find out if this rain is continuing this week, and or is it going to be sunny skies from here out. But to my first story now. Beef, one of Australia's largest exports to the US, is among hundreds of food products now exempted from trade tariffs imposed by Donald Trump. So the US president signed an executive order on Friday in response to concerns over high grocery prices in America. OBE Organic is an Australian company that sends hundreds of tons of beef to the US each year. Managing Director Delene Ray explains how she heard the announcement.
It was great news. I've actually been in the US for the last week. I flew over there on Sunday a week ago and went from the East Coast, travelled from the East Coast to the West Coast visiting customers. And I also attended the Meat Importers Council of America conference in Fort Worth, Texas, and ended up in San Francisco on Friday and was reading the news. And that's when I found out that the Trump administration had got rid of the tariffs that had been applied to Australian beef exports.
How did you feel when you heard that news?
I certainly felt relief. There's a lot of opportunity for Australian beef exports into America. The demand's not going to change. It's just that it will be cheaper for importers in the US to buy our beef, which means that the price on the supermarket shelf for consumers is likely to reduce, which is very important because cost of living is putting a lot of pressure on Americans.
And what does this mean for your business?
It means that there's still an appetite for our product in the US. So the United States has a population of about 340 million people. In Australia, we have a population of 28 million people, give or take. We don't have enough in Australia to consume all of the beef that our farms and properties are raising, or our meat proteins here in Australia. So we need the US. And it means that importers in the US can have confidence that they can continue to buy our product. Now, as your listeners would be aware, we've had once in a generation floods out in Western Queensland earlier in the year. And what that means for us practically is we've got very fat cattle coming out of the Channel Country. So recently we processed a line of animals that were the heaviest and fattest we'd ever processed in the 30-year history of OB Organic. And what that means is we've got a lot of fat meat, you could say, and the home for that is the US.
So you can't find a home for that in like the domestic market or in other export markets?
Yeah, so well, in Australia, because we've only got 28 million people, we don't have enough people eating burgers and making spaghetti mince, whereas in America we do. At the conference that I attended, the Meat Importers Council of America conference, we had a lot of researchers talking. And it's very interesting hearing what consumers over the next decade are looking for in America, and this is 340 million people. So they're looking for antibiotic-free. So that's the leading thing consumers in America are looking for, followed by grass-fed, organic, humanely raised and sustainably raised. So that puts Australian exporters in a really good position because the majority of beef that's exported out of Australia is antibiotic-free. We also heard that the US, the nation's protein craze, is boosting sales in protein foods. For example, jerky. So if you go into retail or service stations here in Australia, you'll see a little bit more jerky or meat sticks on the market. But in the US, it's a market that is $6.2 billion in jerky and meat sticks. And the raw material that's used to make those products are trimmings. And trimmings is anything that comes off an animal that's not your steak or your stir-fry strips. and things like that. So that's all coming out of Australia. And so we've got this huge appetite in the US for protein products. And good for those of us in the beef game, beef is the king in the US. So it's the protein of choice for everyone, followed by chicken, pork, turkey, lamb, and then proteins like bison, elk and rabbit. Again, very good for those of us involved in the beef industry in Australia.
How much product are you sending to the United States?
We're sending hundreds of tons of product out of Brisbane. So we send both sea and air freight to the US. So we put container loads of frozen trimmings out of the port of Brisbane, and we also, through Brisbane Airport, export chilled air freights into California. So in California, we've got consumers that, interestingly, when the product lands, even though it's been exported from Australia, it's flown a long way to get there, it's actually cheaper for consumers to buy our certified organic beef than it is to buy organic beef that's raised in the US. And so that means that there's, particularly in California, there's a lot of people that are looking for product that's clean and safe, and OB Organic, our brand, is able to provide that.
Are you expecting that the demand for your product will increase with tariffs being dropped, as it will be, again, an even cheaper product for the American consumer?
I actually coincidentally went to the US 3 days after President Trump made his announcement in April. I was in the US for another event. President Trump's tariffs didn't decrease the volume going into the US. What it did was increase the cost for importers who were purchasing Australian beef. So there's really tight US supply because of drought in the US. And so manufacturers that make burgers and meatballs and pizza toppings and hot dogs need to buy beef from other countries. So this tight US supply, at the conference I learnt that it's likely to get tighter. So regardless of tariffs, there are people that need hot dogs in America. There are people that need burgers. There are people that need mince to make their meals. And so retailers have to provide it, and in order to be able to do that, they have to buy meat from offshore. There's a shift in consumer preference in the US for protein, which is good, so perhaps away from other food sources into protein. And so US consumers are eating more protein and meat than they ever have, and that'll continue through 2026 and 2027 regardless of tariffs, and they're paying more for it. What this will mean is that consumers had to pay more over the last 6-7 months while this tariff's been in place, and they'll go back to paying a little bit less.
The conference that you attended, you said that, you know, one of the things that Americans are looking for in the long sort of term demand is antibiotic-free, grass-fed. Are they still willing to pay a more of a premium price for that rather than grain-fed and, you know, with antibiotics, even though there's a cost of living crisis? Did that impact at all?
Well, I think in Australia we have 28 million people, and we have people that can barely afford groceries, and we have people that are at the big end of town and can afford more expensive food products. It's the same in America, but it's different in that there's 340 million people. So there's more people below the poverty line, and there's more people that are wealthy. But it's not just wealthy consumers that are looking for antibiotic-free, grass-fed and organic. There's all sorts of reasons why when I talk to consumers, they're thinking about or making decisions to prioritise organic food choices. And it's often that they've experienced some ill health, potentially cancer, and they're starting to do some research and they're thinking about what their food choices are. Interestingly as well, when we look at consumers in parts of Asia and the Middle East, often it's not the parents that are buying the organic food products for themselves, they're buying it for their children. So they may still be wanting to go buy a grain-fed or a Wagyu steak, and they're happy to eat that themselves, but they don't want to give that to their children, and they're looking for a grass-fed or organic mince. It's called ground beef in the US. I had to keep reminding myself of that so that they can make food for their children. So What's really important, I think, is we, in Australia, we've got a small population and we're sometimes in a little bit of a fishbowl. We pat ourselves on the back and say we're awesome, which I think we are. But we sell to consumers around the world, so we really need to be thinking about the consumers and what they're looking for. And certainly at the conference, we heard from enough people saying that consumers are looking to prioritise protein, which is great, and beef over other sorts of protein, but also antibiotic-free, grass-fed, organic, humanely raised and sustainably raised.
What are you hearing from importers specifically?
So importers are certainly from Australia. They're looking for fattier trim. So again, trim is anything that comes off an animal that doesn't go into making beef cubes or stir-fry strips or steaks. And they can get reasonably cheap lean trimmings out of South America, places like Uruguay. Because we've had such a good season here in Australia, the cattle are coming through not only heavy but really fat. And by fat, that means lots of fat on the animal. And what that means is that we're getting a lot of fat trim out of Australia. So our loads to America, for example, might be 50% meat, 50% fat. And that wouldn't have been the case 12 months ago, but we've had the flood. The animals have been able to graze on native pasture. They've done really well off those, and the animals are fatter than they've ever been. So that gives us an opportunity to put our product into the US. And again, these big grinders in the US, they're not just buying trim from Obi Organic and grinding it into meat for hot dogs. They're buying from all over the world, and they've got big grinders, and they might be taking product from Obi, and then they might be mixing it with product from Uruguay to get the lean point that they're looking for.
And in regards to the tariffs, how confident are you, and I guess speaking to people at that conference, that with Trump taking them away, that they're going to stay away for now?
A great question. I think we were surprised. Maybe our ambassador in Washington, Kevin Rudd, maybe knew that this was going to happen, but I'm not sure many people in the meat industry did. I think many people in the meat industry were worried that it was going to go up in January, not be taken away. So I think all of us were reasonably surprised. What is at play here is that the Trump administration has made an announcement to get rid of the 10% tariff on Australian exports to the US, but we have other countries that we compete against, one being Brazil, Uruguay, and it looks like he hasn't changed the tariff on imports out of Brazil, which means that there should be more demand for product out of Australia. And the other complication in the US is quota. So what that means is our diplomats did a great job 20 years ago to get rid of quota. There are other diplomats from other countries that haven't done such a good job. So countries like Brazil, for example, they have a quota, and if they exceed their quota, they've got to pay an extra 26% out of quota tariff. So how that plays out in reality is it kicks in January of the year, so there will be a lot of exporters from Brazil that will put product into the US in November, December. It goes into bonded storage. It then drops into the market in January, and by the end of January, Brazil's already hit quota, and so they'll be subject to 26.4% quota along with a 10% and a 40% tariff. So I don't think there are too many people, even our ambassador, that really knows what the Trump administration is going to do. What we need to do is understand that the US is a really important market. We need to be always engaging with our state and federal government contacts to make sure they've got the right information about the industry. It's not only the US where we need our diplomats negotiating market access. Market access can come and go around the world, so we've got to be focusing on other markets. And the Queensland government actually and the federal government is really focused on helping exporters like Obi Organic to find customers in other markets. And I'm just back from Vietnam, and the Queensland government has supported us to find new customers in Vietnam as well. So markets like Vietnam, South Korea and Indonesia are really important markets for Australian protein exporters. So whilst we need to manage the decisions of the Trump administration, and certainly it was a really positive one on Friday, we still need to stay focused on other export markets and the opportunities in those markets.
Obi Organic Managing Director Delene Ray. Now, another Australian red meat exporter says the US lifting its 10% tariff on Australian beef will make little difference. Casino Food Company CEO Simon Stahl shared his thoughts on Donald Trump's tariff reversal with Kim Honan.
Well, not really a relief in terms of the trade, because as we all understood, that there's such short supply in the US that the consumer was going to pay for that 10%. But certainly a relief that getting rid of tariffs is a positive thing. And so we really appreciate that, I guess.
And so while you did think that, ultimately it was the American consumer that, would be taking on this extra cost, this 10% tariff, did it hurt the Australian beef industry?
No, it didn't. The tariffs, I'm not sure what he's doing with the South American tariffs. He may remove the 50% or may have. But again, there's a shortage of good quality beef around the globe. So really it's only going to just move the deck chairs. So if the Brazilian beef starts going back into the US, then there'll be less for China and Asia, et cetera, et cetera. So fundamentally it still looks good for Aussie beef.
So you don't think the competitive advantage that Australia had over other red meat exporters such as Brazil that were slugged with higher tariffs will be lost?
Oh, certainly the advantage in the US over Brazilian beef will be lost. However, it'll find a new market, and I just don't see it having an effect on prices overall because, as I say, demand is above supply in terms of quality red meat across the globe.
And had we increased the amount of beef we exported to America, since April?
I believe so. US has certainly powered on and the exports are year on year increasing. And again, it's on the back of the short supply in the US.
The coalition has scrapped its net zero by 2050 goal. What are your thoughts on this? Certainly something that your company has been striving towards is, reducing carbon emissions.
Yeah, well, certainly reducing carbon emissions and actually focused on, what we can do in the energy space to lower cost of energy across the board, because I think it is a concern over the longer term, whether it's either side of politics. I think they've got an enormous job lowering cost of power, but we do need affordable power in this country to maintain competitive manufacturing on the world stage. This announcement won't stop companies like ourselves looking for reducing our fossil fuel usage and reducing methane where we can, exposure to the atmosphere. I mean, those projects will go on regardless. I think the net zero and calling to have a look at it, I mean, if you look at net zero in our supply chain, you're taking into agriculture and really cattle livestock has been getting a particular bad rap in my view, because if you eliminated all the cattle in the planet, you're still not going to reduce the global warming. However, you won't feed millions and millions or billions of people. So, it's a bit of a restraint on our industry, or it's a bad call to have this net zero on livestock in particular. So I think people are just saying, well, look, net zero, what does it really mean? How are they measuring it? I think a sensible approach is to say, absolutely, everyone's for getting rid of or lowering where we can fossil fuel use and call it pollution. Everyone's for that. Our company is, and a lot of our customers are demanding that. But I just think this chase for this holy grail of a net zero and what it really means, I think that is something that we can still have some really good objectives and have a sensible discussion about it. So I think it's a good move in the end.
Simon Stahl, CEO of the Casino Food Company in Northern New South Wales, speaking to Kim Honan. It is 23 minutes past 12. Up next, I'll bring you more details on what Simon mentioned just then about the Coalition's energy policy and what this could mean for agriculture.
Join your local ABC team when the sun rises each weekday. Our team is out in the community. We curate the news, weather and your local rural report. Join us for breakfast right here on ABC Local Radio.
On your radio, online and on the ABC Listen app. This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
Had a few texts come through on how much rain people saw at their place over the weekend. John from Tolga said it's dry as up here on the Tablelands. That's no good, John. Hopefully you'll see some of that rainfall shortly. Bowenville received 5 millimetres and 10 Cades North 3 millimetres. Gazza in Rocky said 74 mils since 7 a.m. yesterday on the range. Thank you so much for your text today, and let me know how much rainfall you got at your place over the weekend. There were some pretty big totals around a few different parts of the state. Send me a text 0487 993 222. But to my next story, because the Coalition has unveiled its new climate and energy policy after dumping net zero by 2050 last week. So unlocking gas supply is central to the plan, but opposition leader Susan Lee has also left the door open to new coal-fired power stations as a source of baseload energy to back up renewables in the electricity grid. The plan also includes stripping Labor's 2030 target of 43% emissions reduction from legislation. Ms. Lee says affordable power for homes and businesses will be prioritised over reducing emissions.
With this very strong message where we explain that we can have emissions reduction and power prices coming down, that's what our plan is about. With Labor, you've got power prices going up and you don't even have emissions coming down. Now, how does that work and why is that fair? Not just to families now that I meet every day that are facing this struggle, but to the next generation. Sabra, the cost of everything that it takes to build a house is going up. And we're getting the production line from offshore. Labor is punishing the people and the industries who make things in Australia. And costs are going through the roof. And it makes no sense when you consider the actual scorecard, which is that prices are going up and emissions are flatlining.
How do you respond then? I mean, CSIRO GenCost found that renewables remain the lowest cost new build electricity generation technology in Australia.
Well, if that's the case, Sabra, why has the price gone up 40%? Because what people may misunderstand is that...
But you're airbrushing out things like to the Ukraine war and hangover from COVID?
We've moved well past that. And the point I want to make is that renewables have their place.
Those things pushed up inflation.
40% increase and no sign of anything other than continual increases under the government. But I just want to explain why. Because renewables are expensive when they are firmed and moved into power generation. I believe in the transition to renewables, but in rushing the transition, what we're doing is pushing prices up.
CSIRO GenCost report from July this year found that renewables remain the lowest cost new build electricity generation technology. Do you not think that the CSIRO is founding its report in science and economics?
Well, the reality is that prices are going up. They've gone up by 40%.
And so they're wrong?
Renewables, I'm not going to comment on lines from reports. I'm commenting on what's going on in the real world around me. And the real facts, the conversion to reliable baseload dispatchable power, which needs gas, it needs pumped hydro, it needs long-term battery storage. We believe in all those things happening, but the rate that they're happening under this government is pushing prices too high.
Opposition leader Susan Lee speaking with Sabra Lane. So what does the agriculture industry think about this new direction? National Farmers Federation President Hamish McIntyre spoke to Sally Sara.
Yeah, look, our position hasn't changed in agriculture, Sally. The NFS supports an economy-wide aspiration of net zero by 2050, but not for agriculture. You know, food and fibre production must and always will come first. Farmers across Australia, you know, spend every day turning CO2 into food and fibre, and always have and always will.
So the NFF doesn't support net zero by 2050?
It supports an economy-wide aspiration, but agriculture has never been in, and we haven't changed our position in that area at all.
In this policy, the Coalition will also focus on what's known as breakthrough technology that doesn't yet exist. So what are your thoughts on that approach?
Yes, look, I mean, there's all sorts of technologies out there. I mean, agriculture is at the cutting edge of new technology that, improves our production and our viability. We have many, many technologies that are working in around the farm fertiliser areas, and it will always continually change that area. But at the moment, things are working well, and we are, reducing our emissions naturally.
The Liberal leader, Susan Lee, says carbon capture and storage has come a long way. What are the projects that you want to see funded for the farming sector?
Just what's already out there. I mean, there's great projects around soil-borne carbon. you know, organic carbon is very important to agricultural production, and that's going through our root system from our plants. That continues, and that's our best spot to store carbon, and we'll continue to.
The coalition would also seek to re-establish veto powers held by the agriculture minister that would prevent native forest vegetation projects from going ahead if they had an adverse impact on agricultural production and regional communities. How big of a threat is the loss of land to native forest vegetation or renewable energy projects?
It's a big threat. We support, you know, viable communities across Australian agriculture. What we don't support is prime agricultural land being turned into offsets. It's the land that's available is there to produce food and fibre, and we want to continue that. You know, there's a lot of water has come out of the productive pool too, and water buybacks. What that's doing is driving water prices up for farmers across Australia and irrigators particularly. So it's the same with prime agricultural land. We want it there to be growing food and fibre. Agriculture is not to shoulder responsibility for targets of other industries. They need to use their own technologies to meet whatever targets they have, and not to pass it on to agriculture. So we want to continue to focus on production of food and fibre, and particularly on our very good prime ag land. You know, agricultural communities have got to support any change of use in their areas. So if they do, that's okay. But if they're against it, we're not for it.
You're listening to Radio National Breakfast. My guest is the President of the National Farmers Federation, Hamish McIntyre. Hamish, what do you make of the US announcement in the past few days removing tariffs on beef?
We're back to where we were, which is great. So beef, wine and lamb are important commodities we sell to the US, and the announcement's great for US consumers. Obviously, you get the price of our beef down there. It's a relief that we are back to where we were with the free trade agreement originally.
The Trade Minister, Don Farrell, is expected to meet with European Union Trade Commissioner Marcos Sefcoc this week. It's anticipated that the Australian-EU free trade agreement negotiations will take place. Is the National Farmers Federation getting any sense that we're drawing closer to a conclusion here?
Yeah, we're not sure, but look, we welcome any free trade talks returning to the table. You know, farmers around Australia want this deal done, but not at any cost. You know, it must deliver real and lasting gains for Australian agriculture. Recent global trade disruptions shouldn't mean we lower the bar. If anything, they prove how important it is to get this right, getting a strong and fair agreement that benefits both sides.
National Farmers Federation President Hamish McIntyre. Now, as the debate around net zero intensifies, a North Burnett beef producer says farmers should do their own part for the environment rather than rely on government policies. Carly Burnham and her husband Grant won this year's Australian Government Climate Innovation Award at the National Landcare Awards. They are the country's largest holder of soil carbon credits.
It's a volatile conversation and it's ever changing. What I do understand is Australia set targets with the Paris Agreement, and that was made by, you know, a collection of global leaders and countries. So I feel like it's important to stay in a political way, to stay committed to some of those agreements. But then I also think that whether it's the flavour of the day or it's a political party's policy or sentiment, I still think as farmers, we are so closely reliant on the land and the earth that the more that we can do to give back to the environment will give back to us. And we've experienced that over, you know, decades of beef farming and with our soil carbon project. And by giving more, it really creates more resilience and it bolsters our ag businesses. So whether it's in or not in, I think as farmers and land stewards, we need to be thinking more longer term than just a four-year government term about what we're leaving for the next generation and how we're creating impact.
In 2023, you were issued over 94,000 carbon credits and became, you know, Australia's largest holder of soil carbon credits. How is, I guess, that side of the business all going, and could you explain a bit more about how it all works?
It's quite a new concept and an innovative sort of project that we were invited to in 2016, and we signed up with the Australian Government Clean Energy Regulator. So it's a highly verified project, and there's lots of auditing systems, processes and checkboxes that, you know, we've had to undertake since 2016. And our property was baseline measured. So soil samples, cores were taken, 300 cores on the property at Bonnie Doon to the depth of 1.2 metres. And then they were sent off to a laboratory and in a very scientific process measured how much soil carbon we had in 2016. 5 years later, well, the property was measured again and it showed how much soil carbon had been sequestered in our soils. And so we had to change our management practices. So we went from 30 paddocks to 60 paddocks and added about 40 watering points and boxed up our cattle and started rotating them through smaller paddocks. What we found was an increase in productivity, which was really good for the soil, the pasture and the whole ecology and biodiversity of the property. But it was really incredible in 2023 to finally have the results that we sequestered, over 100,000 tonne of carbon. So what that means is through the use of beef cattle in our grazing system, we've taken, over 100,000 tonnes of CO2 out of the atmosphere through photosynthesis. So we can't actually take any credit because nature does it itself.
Are consumers appreciative of those efforts?
They really are. A small part of our business, we sell boxed beef directly to customers in the Central Queensland area. And more our customers are telling us they love buying direct from a farmer. They love to know that we're doing good for the environment and that it's ethical beef and it's healthy and, perhaps more nutritious because the soil health and the ecological health is, at its optimum. So there is no better way to do market research than have that conversation with the people that are eating our beef. So it helps us to sort of feel like, we're on the right path, and it feels really rewarding to be running an economic ag business that's also giving back to the environment. And we're going into the drought later and coming out earlier because of the more resilience in our whole landscape.
Carly Burnham from Bonnie Doon Organic Beef speaking to Taylor Larson. Weather's up next.
Gallipoli. When it comes to understanding war, art is our secret weapon.
Rachel Griffiths presents When the War is Over.
If it's too risky to say, sing it.
Starts Tuesday, November 18 on ABC TV and ABC iView.
On your radio, online and on the ABC Listen app. This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
It's time to check in on the weather, and Lauren Murphy joins me now from the Bureau of Meteorology. Good afternoon, Lauren.
Good afternoon, Megan.
So, it's a pretty wild weekend when it came to rainfall. Where saw the biggest totals?
Yeah, that's right. We had that cloud band extending across most of the state during the weekend. On Saturday, we saw some severe thunderstorm activity through the southeast, and there are a few isolated totals in excess of 100 millimetres around Rosewood and also around Carelbin on the Sunshine Coast. With those rainfalls, we saw a bit of a creek and riverine response, and we had some minor flood warnings out, which have since been finalised this morning. And then as we moved through Sunday, the focus shifted to the Capricornia in particular. We saw sort of 25 to 50 millimetres widespread through there, including some isolated totals in excess of 100 metres for 100 millimetres, 100 metres is a deep concern, for Calliope, and also around 60 millimetres for the Bundaberg and Gladstone areas too. Yesterday, further north, the shower and thunderstorm activity was a bit more isolated. Through the north, we saw largely sort of 5 to 15 millimetres, with a few places getting in excess of 50 millimetres with thunderstorms as well, like Pentland, Savannah and Wallaman.
And it looks like some of that rainfall caused some minor flooding around the Taroom area. Is that likely to sort of, I guess, go down over the next coming days, or can people expect rises anywhere else downstream as well?
Yeah, that's right. We do have a minor flood warning current for the Dawson River, with expecting some minor flooding around Taroom as well. We'll just keep an eye on the rainfall gauges and the river gauges as they respond to how that water moves through the system. But at this stage, expecting minor flooding or less impacts with that rainfall through the Capricornia.
So looking, I guess, towards the coming week, is this rain likely to continue?
We're seeing a real focus over the next few days with the shower and thunderstorm activity contracting further northwards. So for today, the showers and thunderstorms are likely to be north of a line, sort of Normanton through to Ingham. And we're going to keep an eye on the potential for severe thunderstorms with heavy rain, particularly through that Cape York Peninsula area. And then as we go into Tuesday, the showers and thunderstorms continue to contract northwards. So activity is likely to be north of Cairns during Tuesday. And then as we move into Wednesday, pushing further north to be confined to the north of Cooktown. And then, yeah, further south through southern and central parts, we're expecting to see another weak trough begin to form during Wednesday. We'll see a bit of that moisture return as we go through later parts of the week, and isolated to scattered showers and thunderstorms are forming for central and southern parts as we head towards the end of the week.
What about in western Queensland?
So fine and sunny for those folks out there. We've had some drier air move through, so the fire dangers have notched up a little bit. But the temperatures are cooler. We've seen some cooler southwesterly air move through there, so we're looking at 4 to 6 degrees cooler than usual through western parts, which is a nice bit of relief. And that's set to continue today through to Tuesday. And then as we track towards the middle of the week, we'll start to see those temperatures return close to average, and then winds swing around to a more northerly towards the end of the week with that trough. So starting to see those maximum temperatures climb back towards the 40-degree mark or even higher out through the Channel Country towards Friday.
And what about temperatures across the rest of the state? Are they staying cool in the wake of all this rain, or are they starting to heat back up?
Definitely cool up through the far north under that cloud and shower activity. For the rest of us, through the eastern districts today and tomorrow, with that west to southwesterly flow, a touch warmer than usual, so 2 to 4 degrees above average for those eastern districts, and central parts are pretty close to average.
And in coastal waters, how are winds and swells looking?
It's a pretty relaxed pressure gradient right across the Queensland coastal waters at the moment. So the southern waters, mostly northwest to southwesterly, 10 to 15 knots with a coastal trough moving through there. And then as we track to those northern waters, more sort of northwest to northeasterly, around 10 to 15 knots for the Mackay Coast and Townsville Coast. For Cairns and north, that's largely variable winds, less than 10 knots. And for the southern parts of the Gulf, just some west to south westerly winds, 10 to 15 knots. Swells are all pretty insignificant, less than a metre.
What are the main drivers at the moment that are causing all this rainfall?
So we're starting to see the tropics really wake up through the north. We've also got a tropical low of interest that we're monitoring just off the north of Darwin, O2U, which has got a moderate chance of becoming a tropical cyclone on Wednesday and a high tropical high chance of being a TC by Friday. So just becoming more active across the tropics, deep tropical moisture being drawn across the state with that cloud band yesterday. But yes, otherwise, just largely light pressure gradient further south.
And just can I get some more detail on that potential for a tropical cyclone that you just mentioned?
Yeah, so we're monitoring a low, O2U. It's off the coast of Darwin at the moment. Modelling is pretty keen to keep it over the Northern Territory side of us. So we'll hang around in the Timor Sea, likely strengthening over the coming days. And as mentioned, yeah, moderate chance of being a tropical cyclone from Wednesday, increasing to high from Friday. It does sort of stooge around the Timor Sea midweek, and then it looks like it'll track westwards, well away from Queensland towards the end of the week.
Now, as always, this time of year, especially when there's been a lot of rainfall, in particular in spring, People want to know if, you know, if it's going to be a La Nina called anytime soon. Is there any indication that might be the case?
Yeah, it's looking increasingly likely. The La Nina indices, we've been hovering right on the threshold for a few weeks now. The Bureau typically likes to see that signal sustained for 2 or 3 months. So I think that, yeah, there's a quite strong potential that we'll see a La Nina declared in the coming weeks.
So how long has that been sustained for now?
It's been hovering around the threshold for about 2 months. It's not a convincing signal, and it's quite late in the season. We typically see these climate drivers firm up during spring. So if we do see that La Nina declared, it's likely to be a weak and short-lived one.
Lauren, thank you so much for your time today.
Cheers, Megan.
Lauren Murphy, Senior Meteorologist at the Bureau of Meteorology.
And let's get it on. Friday, join ABC Sport for the first Ashes Test between Australia and England. Hear every ball of the cricket all summer long.
The Ashes.
On your radio and on the ABC Listen app.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
Thank you for your company on the Country Hour today. My name is Megan Hughes, and I'm asking you today what sort of rainfall totals that you've seen at your place in the last couple of days. Brant from Port Douglas said there is heavy rain around Cairns today, and it's just started pouring down in the Mosman and Port Douglas region. Maybe the wet season has finally started. I guess there is no cane cutting to be affected by rain in the Mosman area anymore, sadly. Thank you so much for your text, Brant. And if you want to let me know your rainfall totals, what's been falling at your place, what have you tipped out of the rain gauge, you can send me a text on 0487 993 222. But I will stay in the far north now, because with global chocolate prices soaring due to an ongoing shortage of cocoa, the world is searching for new regions to cultivate this much-loved crop. And Far North Queensland is emerging as a serious contender. And so Australian Cocoa Limited is trying to raise $20 million in capital to buy and expand an existing cocoa plantation in the region and also buy land for further plantation. Jim McCurley is the founder of the Australian Cocoa Limited and spoke with Sophie Johnson.
Part of it will be used to acquire some cocoa assets from Charlie's Chocolates, who have been operating in Mission Beach for about 12 years. And that is taking some of the plantation they've got, the nursery they've got, and the factory that they've got that processes the beans. So that'll be part of it. Part will be to expand that nursery to provide the young plants that we need to plant out extensive plantations, and the balance will be to acquire land in the area and prepare it for planting and plant it out.
By how much are you hoping to expand the industry in Far North Queensland?
Well, look, I think this is a great beachhead. I mean, we hope to have over 300 hectares, which is a substantial amount of land, given at the moment there's probably less than 30 hectares of cocoa in Australia. So we get this one started, and one of the key parts of the plan is the nursery will have the capacity to provide plants for others that might want to move into cocoa, particularly from sugar. The Mosman sugar mill has closed, and the sugarcane growers have got difficulties getting their cane to be milled. The government's ceasing to pay the freight on that from this season. And so there's an opportunity for those farmers to potentially move into cocoa. So we want to make it a new industry for Far North Queensland. I mean, Australia imports $1.5 billion worth of cocoa products, and that is all imported. I mean, and it's just ridiculous. Australia is a very, very good, it's got a very good horticultural heritage and capability. And we want to, you know, work on that and develop that to expand and build a cocoa industry.
So developing this nursery in the hopes that you can get more growers on board, what sort of time frame will this process take up?
Well, it takes a little while for trees to come through a nursery and so on. But this is a 3-year plan that we're working to. And at the end of that 3 years, we will have over 300 hectares planted ourselves, and the nursery will have capacity for other people that want to move into cocoa growing. And but I don't think that we'll stop at the 300 hectares. I think once we're established and the trees are maturing and yielding great fruit, then there's no reason why Australian Cocoa Limited won't continue to expand. But hopefully there's others that can see the value in this and pick up and drive it forward as well.
This sounds all great on paper, expanding an industry like this, but do we have the capacity to process it all?
Oh, yes. Processing it's is not the problem. I don't see that as an issue. Building a processing facility is the one that's there now can handle a significant level of volume above what it's currently got, and expanding and in fact mechanizing that process is something that we look forward to doing. That's going to be part of the research that we'll do into applying some of that good old Australian know-how on how to do things and improve that process. But no, the processing is not is not an issue, and nor is the demand for product. Charlie's gets asked all the time if they've got beans that they can provide to chocolate makers, and of course Charlie itself has been struggling to get enough beans, so the demand is absolutely there.
Founder of Australian Cocoa Limited, Jim McCurley. Now, Chris Janke is the owner of Charlie's Chocolate Factory near Mission Beach in Far North Queensland. He says it's an exciting time for the Australian cocoa industry, and this plan will allow them to expand.
Well, it's really come out of a recognition that there's a worldwide shortage of cocoa. Australia is ideally placed to grow a fair bit of this stuff. And it really required a significant upscaling of the amount of cocoa that's being grown in Australia currently. So it's a case of putting all the pieces together bring about a significant Australian cocoa industry.
And part of that $20 million is going to be used on your farm itself. Can you kind of break it down for me how that will look?
Well, to start with, it's going to involve a significant expansion of our tree plantings, probably around an additional 30 hectares or so, which is about all we've got room for on this place. But not only that, it's also going to be the site of all the infrastructure for the post-harvest processing for all of this cocoa. So there's going to be an expansion of all of the facilities and infrastructure, et cetera, to make that happen. And this will kind of become the central point for all of the processing down the track.
And so will there be expansion as well off-farm?
Yes, there will be. We simply don't have as much land here as we would like, so there will be, in time, purchases of other properties to plant more cocoa.
What difference will this expansion make to you as a grower and producer?
Well, for one thing, it's actually going to mean that when people ring me wanting to buy Australian cocoa, I'm going to be able to say, yes, we can supply you, which up until now I've had to say, no, look, sorry, unfortunately, we haven't got any to sell you. So that'll make my life a lot easier.
Why is this investment so important?
Well, it's like anything else. It just requires, money to make it work. And you've got to grow the trees, you've got to plant them, you've got to look after them when they're little trees. And there's just an upfront capital investment that's required. Now, on our own, we would continue to plant trees and do all that, but at a much, much, much slower, smaller scale than what's being envisaged here. So we would grow eventually in our own right, but it would take decades, whereas this will enable us to achieve that growth in a much, much shorter time frame.
What would you say is the goal of this sort of operation for the Australian cocoa industry?
Well, it's manyfold, really. Number one, it's, an import replacement thing, and it's also security of supply. There's been many reports in the media about the difficulties that the cocoa industry worldwide is having over the last couple of years and will continue to have into the future. And that creates a degree of uncertainty for chocolate manufacturers, small and large. So having a guaranteed supply locally here in Australia, with all of those kind of first world approaches to it, is going to be a significant win for all of those people.
Chris Janke from Charlie's Chocolate Factory. He's also the CEO of Australian Chocolate and the chair of Cocoa Limited. It is 6 minutes to one. Had a few more texts come through. Mike from DLAN said 3.5 millimetres in the gauge Saturday morning, 8 mils Sunday morning and 55 this morning. That is 66 for this event and 229 for November so far. Good soaking rain. Thank you for your text, Mike. Now, Andrew from Catharaba has texted in about my earlier story on the Coalition's net zero policy. He said, any wonder the fossil fuel sponsored Liberal and National parties lost the last election in a landslide to Labor. The entire world is currently experiencing increased power costs, not just Australia. Up next, dairy farms have an opportunity to turn their cow pats into renewable bioenergy.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
So piggeries have been early adopters of biogas and are already leading the way in taking waste and making power, but now dairy farms could take part. Professor Bernadette McCabe from the University of Southern Queensland researches how bioenergy can be integrated into farming, and she expects more dairies will take up projects.
Dairy farmers can look to enjoy the benefits of biogas through what we see as the modernising of their practices, whereby, you know, it was very difficult to actually have the manure captured in our systems, which is largely pasture-based. But as the industry go to more of your mixed ration or full ration, that means that the cows can spend more time in the sheds, therefore the manure can be captured, and that is the key to success for increasing biogas production. It's all about the not just the volume of feedstock, but also the quality of the feedstock as well. But for agriculture, it is in the manure part. But then is also the concept of having agro-industrial, and that's where red meat processors have also been successful in Australia in treating their effluent on site.
Yeah, there were a few companies here who mentioned they were interested in livestock in sale yards and the effluent that you could gather there today. Must be a big opportunity there as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we've seen a presentation around the Wodonga resource recovery, and it's all about having synergistic industries in a location which is going to be logistically important in terms of transport, but to have infrastructure or roads like the Hume next to where you've got trucks carting cattle, you know, that washdown facility is really important. And instead of it being a problem, why not capture that effluent coming off those trucks and to be treated in a facility which is going to bring in all various types of, you know, even trade waste was talked about. Yep.
You also mentioned in your presentation you've done a lot of travel and research into other countries and what they're doing in this area. What are some of the sort of takeaways that you found? Like, who's doing it well and how does Australia stack up?
Yeah, so today's presentation was about a report that I did with my colleagues under the IEA Bioenergy Task 37 Energy from Biogas, which compared and contrasted the ability or the extent for which agriculture has been integrated in into, you know, the biogas systems. And you know, Italy and UK were under the microscope in that report and compared against Australia and Canada. And Italy and UK stand out as the kind of leaders to some extent in integrating agriculture, primarily because they have policies which show that they've got clear mitigation strategies on greenhouse gas emissions, and also the ability to incorporate renewable energy using bioenergy. But the key to those countries as well is that they have the farmer at the centre. They have national bodies which are advocating for farmers. And I think that is the really great opportunity for which Australia needs to bring in to the room, is that farming or leadership or the organisations which represent the farmers.
University of Southern Queensland Professor Bernadette McCabe. That's all we have time for on the Country Hour today. Thank you so much for your company and your text message. Always a pleasure to hear from you. My name's Megan Hughes. News is up next. It's 1 o'clock.